Welcome to NTD News Today. Here are today's top stories. Ukraine's military says Russia is violating the Easter ceasefire announced by Russian President Vladimir Putin yesterday. A military spokesperson says there wasn't much hope for a ceasefire in the first place. New Yorkers flocked to St. Patrick's Cathedral to show off their best Easter bonnet in the annual Easter and Bonnet Parade. NTD's Stefania Cox takes us there. The U.S. Supreme Court temporarily pausing the Trump administration's effort to deport alleged members of the Trendy Aragua. Two conservative justices disagreed. The Trump administration cracking down on illegal immigration, including violent foreign gangs on U.S. soil. How serious is their influence in the U.S.? Arian Pazdar is in Latin America. A win for school choice in Texas. Lawmakers there passed a $1 billion school voucher bill, allowing parents to use public funds for private school tuition. Our guest breaks it down.
This is NTD News Today, live from our global headquarters in New York City.
Thanks for joining us. I'm Don Ma. Ukraine's military says the Easter holiday ceasefire announced by Russia Saturday has fallen apart. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky shared an X post, a new report by Ukraine's commander-in-chief. It says Russia conducted 26 assaults between midnight and noon on Easter Sunday. Statements by both Russia and Ukraine reveal neither side was confident in the other's ability to maintain the ceasefire.
We assume that the Ukrainian side will follow our example. However, our troops should be ready to repel possible ceasefire violations and provocations by the enemy, any aggressive actions. We know that the Kyiv regime, as you have reported to me, violated agreements regarding ban on energy strikes more than 100 times. This is why I ask you to be extremely attentive and vigilant, to be ready for an immediate response in full.
Frankly speaking, we did not really hope for a real ceasefire. We do not count on what Russia says, but what Russia does with its hands. Their hands usually do harm, and they continue to do so. They probably did it with less intensity for a few hours, but we keep our expectations low.
Zelensky speculated about the cause of the ceasefire violation. He suggested either Putin doesn't have full control of his military or he has no intention of making a real move to end the war. However, he acknowledged no air raid sirens had gone off Easter Day. This revelation comes a day after President Trump said he would abandon mediation efforts altogether unless both sides show a genuine interest in peace. President Trump and First Lady Melania Trump, in a statement, observed Holy Week saying, quote, "As we focus on Christ's redeeming sacrifice, we look to his love, humility, and obedience." Continuing, the presidential couple says, quote, "We pray that America will remain a beacon of faith, hope, and freedom for the entire world and for a future that reflects the truth, beauty, and goodness of Christ's eternal kingdom in heaven." Other U.S. lawmakers also marked Easter in their own ways. Vice President J.D. Vance writing on X on Friday that he went to church with his family in Rome while meeting with Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni. Secretary of State Marco Rubio called on all nations to respect the rights of Christians to declare, quote, "Christ is King." And in the Vatican, the 88-year-old Pope Francis appeared during Easter Sunday Mass. He's been recovering from pneumonia. Back here in New York City, Easter festivities are in full bloom just a few blocks away from here. Loyal locals and tourists alike are gathering in front of St. Patrick's Cathedral in their fanciest homemade hats. The Easter Parade and Bonnet Festival is on in New York City today. Our Stefania Cox is there now. Steph, how's it going?
Yeah, hey, Don. It is great. It is so lively here right now. So many people here really bringing their creativity to this parade, as you can see with the folks behind me. There's a range of styles, ensembles, people in whole outfits. They've got bonnets that are two levels high. We've got bunny ears. We've got sweets galore. There's all kinds of things happening. And this group here behind me has put in their hearts into their outfits. Let's start with you. Tell me about your outfit.
Well, we're bringing a little mushroom forest to New York with our snail and our mushroom hats.
Lovely. And what's this guy's name?
Estrella.
Oh, nice. All right. So a little snail here. Tell me about your outfit.
Oh, I just put it together with the pink and blue and made it lively.
Love it. Love it. And these little girls down here, are you enjoying the festivities?
Yes.
Bunny ears. Very nice. Tell me about your outfit. How did you put this together?
Lots of glue gun and lots of B7000 glue holding all those little glitters.
Awesome. Do you guys come often?
Yeah, we're with the Imperial Court in New York. I've been coming for about a decade. We're a fundraising organization for the LGBTQI world, throwing all kinds of parties throughout the year.
And you're giving out sweets.
Candy and some headbands for people that didn't make a bonnet.
Nice. Okay. And tell me about your outfit.
I just love celebrating on Fifth Avenue. It's the best. Everyone's so joyful and having such a great time. So it's so, I'm so grateful to be here. So fun.
Awesome. You know, this is a tradition, actually. Yeah, it's very crowded here. This is a tradition dating back to the 1870s. This is a tradition dating back to the
1870s.
You want to get a photo? You can take a photo.
Yeah.
This is a tradition dating back to the 1870s, where wealthy New Yorkers would come out and showcase their finest attire after Sunday Mass for Easter. But it actually traces back even further to Europe, where people would wear their finest outfits. Thank you, sir. As you can see, it's very crowded here. There's actually hundreds and hundreds of people. And what happens is people come out and they just mill around and take photos of each other. It's like a big social event still continuing today. You know, started back in the 1870s and it has not stopped, that fascination. So I'm going to toss it back to you. We'll be sticking around. Chat more later.
Well, those hats certainly are fancy. It seems like the people there put a lot of effort into it, a lot of excitement, enthusiasm in the crowd over there. Thank you very much, Steph. Happy Easter, and for that report. Coming up, the Texas House passes a $1 billion private school voucher bill. This is a bill. Is it a game changer for education in Texas? We discuss with the former special education teacher. Stay tuned after the break. The Texas House has passed a universal school choice bill, and here to discuss that is Aaron Boxer, former special education teacher and CEO of Diversified Education Services. Good afternoon to you, Aaron, and happy Easter. So to start off, could you briefly just tell us, what does this bill do?
Thanks so much for having me on, and happy Easter to all those who celebrate the holiday. Texas is on the brink of implementing one of the most ambitious school choice programs in the nation. The proposed legislation, it introduces something called education savings accounts, or ESAs, and that's going to allocate up to $10,000 per student annually for private school tuition and related educational expenses. There's also going to be additional funding for special education students as well. So actually up to $30,000 for those who are disabled. This initiative is going to prioritize low-income families and those with disabilities, and it's going to aim to provide an equitable educational opportunity across the state. So this is a comprehensive strategy, and it really signifies a commitment to enhancing education outcome for all students, whether they remain in public school or opt for alternate educational paths like private school. They're now going to have school choice.
So Governor Greg Abbott called this bill an extraordinary victory for parents. Why is that? Would you say this bill is, in fact, a game changer for education in Texas?
Absolutely. This is a big picture piece that isn't always discussed. What's happening in Texas is not isolated. It's part of a growing national realignment. States like Florida, Arizona, and Utah, they've already passed universal school choice policies, and they're seeing real results. Better outcomes, happier families. Now, Texas is one of the largest economies and populations in the states. and it's really stepping up. And to be honest, what Texas does, other states are now watching. So we're seeing actually a return to federalism, where education is governed more at the state level as it was originally intended. And that's something President Trump emphasized, that the Department of Education at the federal level has too much centralized power, and this is Texas answering that call. If this works, and I believe it will, you will see a domino effect across the country.
So perhaps maybe arguing against this, critics might say the bill could drain public money or drain money from public schools. How do you respond to that?
Yeah, rural communities often face unique challenges. They're the ones that usually would lose in a situation like this prior to the new bill being passed, where educational access is a little bit more limited because they're in rural communities. And the ESA program could incentivize the establishment of new private and charter schools in these areas. And that's going to expand educational opportunities. So furthermore, the increased funding for public schools will benefit rural districts, and it ensures that all students have access to quality education regardless of their location. And also, these spending accounts are similar to what people have in health spending accounts, where it can be used in different ways. So if there's not a school in their area for them to choose school choice, they can use it for, actually use it for therapy. They can use it for school supplies. So there's a lot of different ways that they can use these flexible spending accounts for education.
What's the level of concern here of deepening the divide between well-funded and underfunded schools? Because since school funding often depends on student enrollment, if many students leave public schools, right, those schools may lose funding.
This has been one of the biggest talking points for opponents that have used this to stall school choice in Texas for the last 30 years. And frankly, it's valid on the surface, but short-sighted in practice. The truth is, yes, many rural families don't currently have a private school nearby, but that's not a reason to block this bill. It's the opportunity. When you give families the resources, the funding to choose, new providers will follow. That hasn't really happened yet across the country. And that's how markets work. Private schools, religious schools will emerge to serve rural areas once there's a financial support for them. It's no different than how hospitals or stores, even broadband, came to small towns once there was a demand and a reason to invest. This bill is not about abandoning parts of Texas. It's about financially including them. And not to forget the companion spending bill passed with near unanimous bipartisan support, and it poured money into all public schools, rural ones included. So if you're a rural district and you don't have a private school nearby, you're not losing anything. You're only gaining from better public school funding with the potential for more educational opportunities in the future.
And Aaron, can you also talk to us about how this bill may impact school quality or education quality in your view?
Well, let's bust a myth right now. This legislation, which sometimes comes across as anti-teacher, it's not. It does more for teachers than we've seen in years. I mentioned the companion funding bill. It increases teacher pay significantly. That was the bill that was passed along with the school choice bill. They're raising per pupil spending. They're raising the amount that they're paying teachers. But more importantly, this is about changing the culture in education. Right now, many teachers feel overworked, underpaid. They're buried in bureaucracy. The unions speak for them politically, but not always practically. So school choice forces schools, not teachers, to compete. We live in a capitalistic society and we need competition. Competition can improve results. And that means better working conditions, more parental collaboration, innovation. So that said, and this is not a very popular topic to bring up, but the union influence, the teacher unions are powerful. They help get the politicians elected, and they're resisting because they stand to lose more money and control. They have fewer students, they have less control, and their power is tied to enrollment. So this is about freeing teachers from a system that often is more about compliance than creativity. And in the end, it's pro-parent, it's pro-student, and yes, it is pro-teacher. So if we're honest about where the dysfunction really lies, it's really at the system now, and this is an opportunity to change that system around.
Okay, Aaron, it's always great to hear your insight. Thanks again for coming today.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me. Happy Easter.
Coming up, in a landmark ruling, Britain's highest court defines the term woman as biological. It follows a long-running legal battle over whether men who identify as women should be treated as women by law. That and more after the break. The UK's top court ruling that a woman is a biological female. What does that mean in terms of policy, direction, and biology? To discuss this, NTD Stefania Cox spoke with biologist Colin Wright and policy researcher James Price.
Biologist Colin Wright and policy researcher James Price, good to have you both with us. This ruling ends a long-running dispute between a feminist group and the Scottish government. Colin, to start with, as an evolutionary biologist, could you explain this dispute from a scientific perspective?
Yeah, of course. I mean, this is always, to me, boiled down to biology. It's the reason I started talking about these issues, because there's been a concerted effort by a lot of activists to undermine basic biological concepts and uproot the idea that being a man or a woman is really being an adult human male or adult human female, respectively. These are just these are the reasons that why we have legal recognition for being a man or a woman in the first place. The normative reason is because men and women are different. It's rooted in their biology, and that biology is immutable. So being a man or a woman is not a subjective sense of self. It is a biological reality. Unfortunately, now we have laws in the UK that are going to be reflecting that reality.
And I do want to come back to that aspect of the subjectivity that is inherent to this debate. But first up, on the legal side, this case could impact sex-based rights as well as everyday single-sex services in the UK, such as toilets and hospital wards. James, walk us through the outcome here.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. It is a great day. In some ways, it's quite a farcical day, the idea that the highest court in the United Kingdom, which, for a bit of context, is only 20 years old or so. We never used to have a Supreme Court, and it sort of copied the American system. It always used to be that the senior law lords sat in the House of Lords would rule on these things, which gave there was no such thing as checks and balances in the UK until 20 years ago. And it meant, therefore, that the legal profession was sort of more intimately tied up with what was happening in politics. And so you perhaps get more nuanced takes on this, and it wouldn't be such a cliff edge decision as we saw yesterday. But having said all of that, it's a very good clarifying thing that this has happened, and the consequences will be very large. It will hopefully help us move on from a very poisonous debate, and poisonous actually, sadly, in a literal sense. Centres like the Tavistock Centre in London were, frankly, poisoning children. There were lots of people who were telling young children, you can take puberty blockers and it will be totally reversible, it'll all be fine, it definitely won't render you sterile, it'll have no long-term consequences if you change your mind. And we know these things were not true and that people were lied to. And yet politicians, journalists, all sorts of people were terrified of saying these obvious truths. I was on a phone-in call on a British radio station yesterday, and someone called up and said that because they tweeted to a local Labour Party councillor that men are not women, 16 police officers turned up at this chap's house and confiscated his laptop and his phone and terrified him and his family and threatened him with all sorts of things. It's this almost Stasi-like problem that we've had, and the consequences, I think, will be, as you say, very deep. You're already seeing the Metropolitan Police Force of London telling its trans officers that they can no longer conduct intimate searches of women if they're not themselves biological women. And it's just ridiculous when you think about it that these sorts of things were ever happening because of this sort of modish, then very dangerous fad that has been occurring for the last few years.
Yeah, touching on that issue of the subjectivity of it that you've both brought up, transgender advocates say gender is a truth relative to identity. But if sex is fixed in stone, could both potentially exist at the same time? Colin, over to you.
Well, sex certainly is something that exists in stone. It's there from the moment you're born, actually much, much longer before you're born. The thing that activists had tried to do, though, is try to just replace this biological reality that all the laws are based on with this subjective sense of self. And, you know, I'm always for people, like, you can subjectively think of yourself any way you want to. But at some point, if we're making laws about these things, they need to actually reflect an underlying biological reality. You can't just let people willy-nilly self-identify into these protected categories. Otherwise, these protected categories are meaningless. You know, they're protected for a reason, and that reason is rooted in biology. Now, something that was recently brought up was the fact that the whole gender medicine industry, that's not getting as much attention of this ruling, but this could have profound implications for the whole gender-affirming care industry in the UK, because, again, that practice is rooted in this pseudoscientific notion that someone's sex is a subjective sense of self, it's a social construct, it's a spectrum that can be changed. So we're only seeing this applied to spaces, and that's kind of what's in the news, but this could have huge rippling effects for the whole gender-affirming care industry in the UK.
And we heard it earlier, the co-director of the group that brought the case for Women Scotland, Susan Smith, said after the ruling that women can now feel safe. So let's take that first from a legal perspective, dig into that a little more, and then on the biological side. So first with you, James.
Yeah, absolutely right. You'll note that this was a campaign group up in Scotland, and because Scotland has one of the few bits of a sort of federal system in the UK, we don't have states with their own powers in quite the same way that you do. This gender woo-woo, if you want to call it that, was being really peddled in Scotland in a very big way. There was a kind of radical progressive government in charge of the Scottish government that was pushing all of this stuff. And it fell to someone like J.K. Rowling, the author of the Harry Potter series, who's lived most of her life in Scotland and has enough money to not worry what people say about her and therefore to stand up for what was right, who financed and funded this campaign, and good on her. You know, she has been denounced by the actors who played Harry Potter and Ron and Hermione, but she was right and she was brave enough to stand for it. And the reason was that in Scotland in particular, you were seeing crazy examples of, you know, a rugby match where someone in a women's only rugby match, and I don't know how many of your viewers will have watched rugby, you don't get that much protective padded kit like you do in the NFL. Someone, a big 6'3" chap like me, saying he's a woman, going and tackling biological women. It can cause serious damage there. And even worse than that, you started to see men identifying as women so that they could get into women's prisons. And not just men, these were rapists, multiple rapists convicted of the rape of women, who were then started to put on a kind of dodgy looking wig and say, oh, actually, I'm a woman, you should put me in a women's prison. And the Scottish devolved government was saying, yeah, okay, if you're a woman, you say you are, brilliant, let's put you in there. And on some cases, they've been put into those prisons. And what have these rapists gone and done? Well, I'll leave it to your imagination, but they've gone on to do the very crimes again that they were accused of doing. Now, this will all start to be unwound, and I think that's a very good day indeed for women's safety.
All right, thank you for that. And Colin, from the biological perspective, this statement, women can now feel safe.
Yeah, I mean, you don't need to have a PhD in biology to understand that men and women are different, you know, not just in the sort of personalities, preferences, and behaviors we tend to have, but our physical bodies. I mean, when you look at things like sports, depending on the sport, there's as much as between a 10% and a 50% difference in outcomes, talking about strength and speed and power and that type of thing. So for sports, for sure, this is a safety issue. If you have men who are just, you know, these elite athletes who are competing against women, just by the mere fact that they're just bigger, faster, and stronger, and can inflict much more force on women. And then, as I mentioned, the psychological side of things. Well, we know based on all the data available that men are more prone to sexual violence than women are. Many men are in prisons because they've committed rapes, and now you're getting this sudden what they call as prison onset gender dysphoria. Now a lot of criminals, rapists, when they go to prison, they're just identifying as women to try to get into women's prisons. And again, it's a common sense thing. You should not be housing violent criminals who've had specific violence against women and committed rapes. They shouldn't be housed in women's prisons. This is just completely common sense, and it's crazy that we've ever been doing it in the first place.
James, it's intriguing that this case started with a 2018 law that tried to create equality in the Scottish Parliament. That law said there should be a 50% female representation on the boards of Scottish public bodies, but the law also included transgender women in its definition of women. What does that say to you about the practicality of creating mandates like this, and how else fairness can be brought about if not through mandates?
Yeah, well, it's very difficult, isn't it? And I think that it speaks to a broader rot at the heart of all of this sort of identity stuff, that people should be chosen for whatever the job may be, whatever the task may be, based on their merits. And if those merits might include immutable characteristics of men being more aggressive, women being more empathetic, whatever those broad stereotypes may have any root in them. They should be chosen for that, but the law cannot and should not be used to mandate these things. And it actually goes back to another law, the Equality Act of 2010, that was put in the dying days of the Labour government. They knew that they were going to lose power very soon, and yet put this very radical piece of legislation through that has opened the door for all the kinds of identity politics that have been happening. And we see examples in other areas of people's, we might call, immutable characteristics, where a police force up in Yorkshire in the north of England has started openly saying that they will not hire white people as police officers. You know, and these sorts of things happen all the way along. Well, I suppose, you know, would you include someone who's, you know, 90% white? Are you going to ask them? Are you going to go and see, well, can I go and see your family history to know exactly how white you are or aren't? And this is the same kind of problem when you start judging people on these things rather than, as one of your great Americans once said, on the content of your character. And this will hopefully be a major win in us trying to get back to a level of sensible decision making and sensible law, not just on sex-based issues, but on everything else as well. And we can go back to a kind of functioning meritocracy where we look at the things we have in common with one another rather than trying to drive great wedges between each other.
On that point, Colin, I'm just wondering if you have any thoughts on the role of the scientist, the individual science and culture within science and among scientists in defining transgenderism and supporting transgenderism as an identity.
Yeah, you know, I'm kind of old school in the sense that I think scientists should describe the way the world is and not really tell people what to do with those facts. You know, that's kind of the realm of politics. But we're kind of getting this blend that we see, the activist scientist who not only has what I would view as these woo-woo pseudoscientific ways that they're viewing the world, but then they're fervently trying to inflict these views on the world. And in many cases, the activism is first and foremost, and the science is kind of just like hitching a ride on the side there. You know, there have been plenty of studies that have tried to look at things like the transgender brain, claiming that trans women have brains that appear more closely to the female sex than to the male sex. These studies are completely flawed. They're usually not controlling for things like previous hormone use, because we know hormones actually change the way your brain structure looks. And also they don't control for things like sexuality, which we know is also correlated with different brain differences. It's this desperate attempt to try to find this immutable characteristic, which in reality, it's just sort of this social phenomenon. You have people who are very gender or sex nonconforming, and they have a distress based on this, and then they seek transgenderism as a way to alleviate some of this stress. But this doesn't mean that being trans is a fundamental biological trait that you're born with, okay? There's a huge social and cultural component to this.
Now,
just coming on that, just
yeah, for sure.
Both of you will find this quite extraordinary that the British Foreign Secretary, who is, I suppose, our equivalent of Marco Rubio, Secretary of State, when he was asked about this issue, because all of the Labour Party, including the Prime Minister Keir Starmer, now have been asked, you know, can a woman have a penis, and all these very invasive questions, and they've all dodged the question and the answer for a long time. But the Foreign Secretary or the Secretary of State, once was, when he was asked about this, showed such a level of scientific lack of knowledge that he once said, well, I think actually you can grow a cervix now, actually, with modern science. You know, just extraordinary ascientific practices by these sort of activists Colin has just described there, muddying the waters. And when you've got politicians who are that likely to fall for these sorts of things, what else are they falling for?
Yeah, it does seem like there's obviously quite a culture forming around transgenderism for this to have come up even. But the former Scottish Nationalist Party politician Joanna Cherry had said that the British government and the Scottish regional government must make sure that public policy changes after this ruling, which to me sounds like there could be some inertia there. What do you think on the ground is going on?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. The termites have burrowed very deeply, and they've dined for a long time and very well. And so you see this through the civil service, the administrative state. You see this through all the various quangos of NGOs and regulators and everything else. And they kind of mad rush to try not to be offensive, which I suppose is a nice impulse in its way. And this idea that the kind of transgender social phenomenon that's been described by my other panelists so well was perhaps actually the new gay rights or women's rights or something like that. And therefore, people were very scared about it. And they have entrenched this stuff very deeply. And it is going to take quite a long time to root all of this out. And I suspect that although this is a high watermark of the victory, that, as you say, that, the rear guard actions that will be fought by some of these people who have dedicated so much of their lives and sent so many threatening messages to politicians and other people, and who maybe have done, you know, very, very brutal things to their own bodies, or worse, perhaps to their children's bodies, will have a kind of motivated reasoning in continuing to believe this stuff is true when it's not. And I do feel for these people, because they have been told by so much of the establishment that these untruths that they have been led to believe were true, and that must be a very dangerous and painful thing for them. Nevertheless, the priority should be, as we've said before, about protecting women and children who have been the biggest victims of this whole craze.
On that point, Colin, transgenderism as a phenomena has grown in recent years, especially among the youth. What do you think's behind that?
You know, there's so much different things behind it. I don't think it can be boiled down to one specific thing. I think, you know, a lot of the activists want to say that this is just greater social acceptance of people who are trans. And I mean, there is perhaps some of that. There is certainly greater awareness of the phenomenon with things like Caitlyn Jenner getting the front page of, I think, was it Vogue magazine, things like Jazz Jennings. So all of these have kind of put transgenderism into just the kind of the cultural air that we're all breathing. There's also this idea of a social contagion, because we see this is really affecting girls more often than boys. That used to be flipped around. And we know that girls are more susceptible to social contagion, things like anorexia and bulimia, that type of thing. And then, I mean, I've written pieces that also just look at the expanding definition of what it means to be transgender in society. And if you look at the US medical organizations, even in the UK, it sort of defines being transgender as this umbrella term for anyone who identifies with or has behaviors or personality traits that aren't consistent, that have been typically associated with, they would say, sex assigned at birth, but your sex. So they're really literally just transing what we used to just call standard sex and gender nonconformity, you know, tomboys or boys who are more effeminate. By definition, if you look at the CDC's definition, a tomboy is considered trans now. You know, it's just fully encompassed all gender nonconformity. And so if you're a kid who's, slightly sex nonconforming, you look up these definitions, you're trans by definition now, according to these major medical organizations.
Wow, I didn't know that about the tomboy definition. That's quite interesting. James, the Trump administration has been adamant since in its stance towards transgenderism, and we saw the AG, Pam Bondi, just this week announcing a lawsuit against Maine, accusing it of not complying with Title IX in girls' sports. What are you watching for here in the U.S. in terms of the transgender debate and issues surrounding it?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think it's a truism that when the United States sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. And I think that we have definitely caught a lot of this from American campus culture in general. We, all of us in Europe and around the world, have kind of America brain on every issue, which is not always a terrible thing. My wife is American, and I'm very happy that she is. But, you know, we do get all of these trends that come along. You talked about a social contagion just there. This is one that's been so powerful that it's crossed all the way over the Atlantic Ocean. And so hopefully the Trump administration will do what we've seen in the UK. We watched from afar that amazing campaign video. What was it that Kamala Harris is for they, them, Donald Trump is for you. What a wonderfully powerful campaign video that is. And hopefully he follows through on that, because you need to come down on this stuff. And you were just reporting, I think, about various elite American universities that have been the biggest peddler of this kind of ascientific nonsense. We'll hopefully start to see a reduction in federal funding. You look at something like USAID, and we've seen the DOGE efforts here in the UK as well, and the transgender operas and comic books that were being funded by American taxpayers right across the world. Well, a lot of this stuff has started to dry up in the UK, and it seems as if American taxpayer money was even being used on various campaigning efforts in the United Kingdom and across other parts of Europe as well. So please turn that stuff off and let our universities get back to teaching, let our schools get back to looking after children, and we can leave this horrible, sorry old issue behind and actually get on with what really matters.
Yeah, not only us here today, but the world is watching this issue and this topic as it develops. Thank you so much for your time today. Colin Wright, evolutionary biologist, and James Price, policy researcher. Good to speak with you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The U.S. Supreme Court weighing in on the potential deportation of alleged gang members held in a Texas prison. It temporarily stopped the Trump administration from removing the men alleged to be members of the Venezuelan gang Tren de Aragua. The case is pending before the New Orleans-based Fifth Circuit Court. Here's more.
The U.S. Supreme Court early on Saturday paused President Donald Trump's administration from deporting Venezuelan men in immigration custody after their lawyers said they were at imminent risk of removal without the judicial review the court had insisted on. Lawyers for the American Civil Liberties Union filed urgent requests on Friday in multiple courts, including the Supreme Court, urging immediate action. They said some of the men had already been loaded onto buses and were told they were to be deported. The latest escalation is centered on dozens of Venezuelans held at the Blue Bonnet detention facility in Anson, Texas. The ACLU said the rapid developments meant the administration was poised to deport the men, using a 1798 law historically used only in wartime. It would not have given them a realistic opportunity to contest their removal, as the Supreme Court had required. The White House did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the Supreme Court decision. Conservative Justices Clarence Thomas and Samuel Alito publicly dissented from the decision.
That criminals, fraudsters, and illegal aliens.
The case raises questions about the Trump administration's adherence to limits set by the Supreme Court, and it could herald a significant clash between the two co-equal branches of government, potentially even a full-blown constitutional crisis. Trump was elected on a promise to crack down on migrants. He has invoked the 1798 Alien Enemies Act in an attempt to swiftly deport accused members of the Tren de Aragua, a criminal gang originating from Venezuelan prisons, which his administration labels a terrorist group. The president and his senior aides have asserted their executive power grants them wide authority on immigration matters, testing the balance of power between branches of government. At issue is whether the Trump administration has met the Supreme Court's standard for allowing due process before sending the detainees to another country, possibly to the notorious prison in El Salvador where others are jailed. It was unclear on Friday how many people were potentially to be deported and where they might be taken.
The Trump administration's crackdown on illegal immigration continues. Authorities are especially going after alleged gang members as crimes keeps affecting everyday Americans. NTD's international correspondent Arian Pasdar joins us now live from Latin America. Arian, how serious is the impact these gangs are having on the United States?
Hey Don, happy Easter. Good to see you. Look, these gangs are spreading and the impact they're having on the United States is already pretty serious. We have MS-13 from El Salvador and we have Tren de Aragua from Venezuela. One of the main issues is how these gangs make money. For example, by human smuggling, which is terrible for the victims, of course, because they often face violence, rape, and even death in some cases. But this is also bad for the US because it increases the number of illegal immigrants entering the country. Another way these gangs make money is drug smuggling. Now, just this month, Trump administration officials announced that they seized $500 million worth of narcotics off the coast of Florida. Now, Don, just imagine how many Americans could have died because of those drugs. So these things are happening right now. And just on Friday, President Trump again talked about the need to stop it. Let's take a look.
Gang members, drug dealers pouring into our place. And you know what? Our people voted for me to get them out. They want them out. They want them out. And we've done a hell of a job. And by the way, Ecuador and various places, but El Salvador. We've been helped by a lot of other states.
So we just saw President Trump, and just to add here, Don, real quick, if no action is being taken against these gangs, then they start spreading to different countries, as is already happening. Don?
Right, Arian. And we also just saw President Trump talking about Ecuador, which is a country we usually don't hear that much about. What's happening there?
Right, Don. So Ecuador just had an election exactly 1 week ago, and the incumbent right-leaning president He won by a whopping 12 percentage points. One of the reasons he won this re-election is exactly gang crime, which was pretty serious in Ecuador. There was one example which was pretty scary. I think you might be seeing this on screen right now, where armed gang members took over a public TV station. Now look at this, they just stormed the studio as this public broadcaster was live on the air. And Don, these things are not just happening in Latin America, this happens in the US too. You might remember last summer when armed gang members took over a residential building in Colorado. I think you might also be seeing these images on screen right now. This doesn't look like it's happening in the US, but this happened in Colorado. Now, just this week, the Trump administration allocated 600 miles of the southern border to the army. And those troops will be stationed there, you know, heavily armed. Todd Bensman, who's a senior fellow with the Center for Immigration Studies, he tells us that these American troops might have to defend themselves amid attacks from such violent gang members. Let's take a look at that.
And if they do fire back, it will be with overwhelming firepower. You've seen those striker brigades down there. They've got the 10th Mountain Division down there, the U.S. Army.
So Don, there are all these threats. There's human smuggling, there is drug smuggling, and even violent takeovers. Don?
All right, Arian, thank you very much for that report. Coming up, a psychiatrist who does specialized brain scanning reveals coffee's effect on the brain. Stay tuned for that when we come back. Welcome back to NTD. I'm joined in studio by NTD health correspondent and host of Epoch TV's Vital Signs, Brendan Fallon. Vital Signs zooms in on important aspects of health that influence our lives. So, Brendan, it's very good to see you. I think this is our first time doing this together on Sunday, that is. So what do you have for us today?
Coffee. It's interesting you were just saying, Don, that you don't drink. I think that's something we could explore a little bit. But it's America's favorite beverage. It's drunk more than bottled water is drunk in this country. And today I have a part of an interview I did with a psychiatrist. He does these specialized brain scans, and he comes from the standpoint of really being able to show and talk about what's happening in the brain when someone drinks coffee. And this is Dr. Daniel Amen. So we'll take a look at this.
The reason I'm not a big fan of caffeine is it constricts blood flow to the brain. Anything that constricts blood flow prematurely ages the organ. So, again, you know, I'm really not a fan of marijuana. I'm also cautious with caffeine. And then, you know, for kids, it's all the energy drinks. They mix caffeine and sugar. It's like two bad things for your brain. And then we're going to get all these sports teams or, you know, famous people to say, oh, I drink Red Bull. And kids think it's cool when that's not something children should be consuming.
What is it actually doing to the brain? What's happening in the brain when someone drinks caffeine?
It constricts blood flow, but it also suppresses a chemical called adenosine. And adenosine is the chemical that throughout the day slowly builds up and it tells you to go to sleep. Well, caffeine blocks adenosine so you don't feel tired. The problem is adenosine is still going up, but it blocks the effect of it and you end up with a rebound the next day. And that's why people start their days with caffeine, because what they're really doing is medicating sleep deprivation. And I would just argue if you get rid of caffeine, your sleep's going to be better, your energy's going to be better. It's a short-term fix that continues to cause a long-term problem.
You know, it's interesting that interviewee that you talked to speaks about how coffee could potentially age you prematurely. That's pretty interesting.
Yeah, it's surprising. I mean, I was a little bit apprehensive about coming on and speaking about the dangers of coffee because I know how popular it is, and I was concerned maybe you were a coffee fan and it might kick me off the show. But
I wouldn't do that to you, Brandon.
Thank you. I mean, there's so much evidence out there for the benefits of coffee. I mean, there was a study from the Southern University of China that actually it showed a link between drinking a certain amount of coffee each day, whether it's sweetened or unsweetened, and having a lower risk of death by any cause. So there's plenty of indicators in the opposite direction as well. So I just wanted to balance the argument a little bit with bringing this perspective.
I wonder if your guest spoke to this point. I'm wondering if coffee just, you know, makes you not feel the effects of sleep deprivation or tiredness, but in fact your body is still experiencing that. You're just not aware of it.
I think so. Yeah, I think, and personally, I don't drink coffee to keep myself awake because I end up feeling worse. It doesn't make me feel any sharper, but I tend to feel dehydrated. And I mean, yeah, the body is still tired, and that chemical that he talks about is still building up in the system, the adenosine, and it's just going to kick in once the caffeine wears out. It's going to kick in harder, and then you're going to need more to kind of stay awake.
Yeah, coffee doesn't really work for me. That's why I don't drink it. I did an experiment where I was extremely tired, and I just had some coffee to see if that tiredness would go away. So I had the coffee, and it turns out after that, I could still immediately fall asleep. Because I was tired, right? So I drank coffee, and immediately afterwards, I could take a nap. So that's why I don't drink coffee. It doesn't work for me.
Makes sense. Yeah, different strokes for different folks. What we'll see here, this is the story of an airline pilot who was a patient of Dr. Amon's, and this is how coffee was affecting him and what Dr. Amon suggested in this case.
One of my favorite stories is an Air Force pilot who came to see me, and his brain looked way older than he did. And he wasn't using marijuana, but he was addicted to caffeine. He'd have anywhere from 6 to 12 cups a day. And he's like, but I can't live without it. And I'm like, no, that's a lie. You can live without it. I said, and if you want to like just stop, well, you probably feel bad for 5 or 6 days. The other option is just go down by 10% a day. And he chose that, didn't have any withdrawal symptoms. A month later, he was stunned with the amount of energy he had, with how much better his sleep was. And it's the little lies we tell ourselves, I often say, that keep us fat, depressed, and feeble-minded. You know, I need this. And the fact is, the brain is lazy. The brain does what you allow it to do. And good habits take just as much energy as bad habits. Now, you have to sort of reshape your brain. That takes a bit of energy.
And if you want to see the full interview, go on Vital Signs. Looking at marijuana, alcohol, and food additives and the impact on the brain, you can go to ept.ms/brainoncoffee. And that's it. Stay tuned for us. We're going to come back after the break.